On this episode of Narcissist Apocalypse, we talk with an abuse survivor named Cece. And Cece was in a toxic relationship with a financial abuser. It's a story of narcissistic mothers, belief systems, trust tricks, and using PTSD as a weapon. Welcome to Narcissist Apocalypse, everyone. This is a podcast that gives the voice to survivors of toxic relationships. I am Brandon Chadwick, but my friends call me Chad, and thanks for tuning into this episode. So what is a narcissist, you may ask? Well, for the purposes of this podcast, we refer to a narcissist as anyone who has displayed a pattern of behavior that shows a limited capacity to appreciate others' perspectives. It is that simple. And now, if you want to be a guest on our show, please go to our website at narcissistapocalypse.com. Top of the page, there's a button that says guest form. Click that button, fill it out. We'll go back and forth on emails for a bit, and we will go from there. Please send everyone out there, send your stories in. We always need stories. And, we record a lot. We record pretty much with everyone who sends in a story. Not every episode makes it to air, but we go through the whole entire process to figure that out. So just keep on sending in those stories. We could never have enough. Can't really reiterate that more than I already have. So thank you for doing that in advance. And also, another way to be part of our show is to go to narcissistapocalypse.com and to be part of our Letters to Our Narcissist compilation episode. On the side of our page, there's a floating button that says Send Voicemail. It records up to 5 minutes. If you need to record twice, you press it twice. Or if you need to record 10 minutes, you press it twice. I'm slow. I've been editing a lot today, everyone. So go to narcissistapocalypse.com if you want to be on our Letters to My Narcissist compilation episode. If you do not want to read the letter yourself and you want me or my old pal Melissa to read the letter for you, just send us an email at narcissistapocalypse@gmail.com and put Letters to My Narcissist in the subject line. And if you want to support our show, join our Patreon. Yes, we have a Patreon. If you want to hear episodes that never made it to air, follow-up episodes with former guests, and much more, join our Patreon. We also have virtual support groups through Zoom every Wednesday and Saturday from 9 to 11 p.m. Eastern. We also have our own online forum boards, which we think are safer than the ones on Facebook. And to join, just go to patreon.com/narcissistapocalypse. Join today, be a patron of our Patreon, help support the show. And other ways to help support the show, well, if you may have noticed, I'm slipping up my words, you may have noticed we started to do advertising on the show, and we are trying to learn more about our demographics. So we are actually having a bit of a raffle where we are going to have 10 winners of $25 gift cards to Amazon. If you fill out one of our survey forms, we're going to have that little survey button in the show notes of the show. You can click on it. It will take you to the survey, and we will go from there. We were doing that draw September 1st, 2021, so please help us out by filling out all that information for us. And what else do we have here? I just want to talk about this episode with Cece. And this is a really interesting episode. There's really two stories here. And we discuss her family life with her mom for much longer than we normally would. Because it was very, very important for the rest of the story for you to understand everything. It's a really interesting, both little stories are interesting. Obviously, the relationship story is the bulk of this show, but her story with her mom it's heartbreaking, but it really is important. And we had to kind of get through all the little things for you to really understand what made CCCC and what was her kind of belief system going into her relationship. So there's also with this, at the beginning of this podcast, we were recording, and I guess there was background noise from a cars that were kind of going by. We eventually changed that, so please bear with that. And now, without further ado, here is my episode with Cece. Welcome to Narcissist Apocalypse, everyone. With me today, we have Cece. How are you?
Fine, Chad. How are you?
I am good. And today we are going to hear your story. Your story is one where you thought you were healed, and you thought, not that you were healed, but you thought that you knew all of the signs to look out for. So, you know, that's something that's hard to deal with. And, you know, it's a long road to kind of go through. You have to do a lot of work on top of the work that you already did. So I want to thank you for being here and sharing. Your notes that you sent to me were superb. It's rare that I get notes that are that thorough. Things are highlighted, bolded, and everything in different spots of all of the learning lessons, explanations of things. So thank you so much for sending that in the way you did. And now I'm going to get out of your way. Cece, the floor is now yours.
Well, thank you. It's an honor to be able to do this. I appreciate the opportunity. I'm going to start just by kind of giving like a little background, because the situation that I thought, you know, I had overcome and healed from was with my family, particularly with my mom when I was growing up. And then it would be decades I would luckily get out of that. And then decades later, I would run into someone else that it would take me a while, but eventually I would realize that what I was experiencing as far as emotion and feeling was the same as I had, you know, in my childhood. And that's what would trigger me to, like, oh my gosh, to look at this, to look at that situation differently. So, so just a little background. I'm not going to use any names or specific places, like cities or states. So I'll just use regions, like East Coast, West Coast, that kind of thing, mm-hmm. if that's okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So, my family is I don't have a big family, and we're not very close knit. It was pretty much just, you know, my mom, my brother and I have a brother who's 3 years older than me. And we were all originally from the East Coast. We're both born on the East Coast. We have the same parents. Other than that, family-wise, was my grandmother. And then my mom has a sister, so I have an aunt and some cousins. But we were never really that close. I don't have any memory of my dad. He was out of the picture when I was really young, and would not have any contact with him later on. So that, you know, that relationship wasn't there. My mom would move us to the Southwest when I was about six. So, and then after we moved, we didn't have any contact with my aunt and my cousins. My grandmother would come visit like every other year. So just not a close family. And the other reason why I make that point is because, you know, my mom was it, right? She was the parent, she was the authority figure, like that's it. And what she said went, and, you know, there was no questioning it or anything like that. But from an early age, I kind of felt like something was wrong. I didn't really feel very connected to her or bonded with her. She wasn't a Betty Crocker mom. She wasn't home baking cookies when we got home from school. She was a single mom and she worked. But there also just wasn't a lot of, like, I don't know, emotion or encouragement or things like that. She would actually, you know, throughout my like grade school and teenage years, she would actually, you know, she would pull every tool from the narcissist's toolbox, I call it. She would body shame me. She would, if someone complimented me, she would correct them or tell them they were wrong or discount it somehow. She would, stop me from doing things that I wanted to do, activities that I wanted to do. She would find a way to, you know, a reason that I couldn't do those things. She would, her favorite threat to me was that she was going to send me away. That was always her favorite threat. I'm going to send you away. But she actually did send my brother to a boarding school at one point when I was like grade school age, because he had some behavioral problems or whatever, and she couldn't deal with him. So it wasn't an empty threat when she was telling me like that she was going to send me away. I had actually seen her do it. So, you know, so this is like the cloud I'm living under as a kid. So I just tried to be like the good kid, the quiet kid, the invisible kid. But the older that I got, just her contempt for me just seemed to grow. And just anything I did, especially if I was good at something, or, you know, it just seemed to make her, you know, not like me more. I would be in gymnastics when I was young. She made me quit that as soon as one of the coaches said, "Oh, she's really good. We need to move her on to the next level." I was like, "No, we're not doing that." Different sports that I would attempt to play in school, like I'd end up having to quit, or I'd get in trouble for something else, and that would be the punishment, was that I could no longer do that. And then at the same time, she would call me fat, and I wasn't at all. Years later, I would see pictures of myself that my grandmother would send me when I was young, and I don't have any of that stuff. I have nothing from my childhood. And my grandmother would send me pictures, and I looked at them. I opened this package expecting to see, like, you know, a little fat kid. And I wasn't. I was tiny. And it just, you know, as an adult looking at those pictures, I knew exactly what, you know, was going on. But as a kid, I didn't know. So she would just, her other favorite thing to do was toss my room like I was a prison inmate. I would come home from school and just, my things would be all over the place, and she would throw away like awards and ribbons and stuff like that I had won, just, you know, just on and on and on. So she would restrict me, punish me for things I didn't do. And I had no voice. There's nothing I could say or do. And then eventually she would, we would move to the West Coast, just my mom and I. My brother was already older and on his own. But she had kind of like disowned him at one point when he graduated from high school because he didn't do what she wanted him to do. She moved us to the West Coast. And then, so I was like 16 at the time. I was in my junior year of high school, and I never had a problem making friends or anything anywhere we lived. Even when we lived in the Southwest, we moved around a lot, like within the same city, but different parts of the city. And I would go to a lot of different schools, but I would always manage to make friends, and that was an adjust. So like that was never a problem for me. So we moved to the West Coast, and I did the same thing I always did. Like I made friends right away, and I even I used to also babysit from a really young age. So I started babysitting again because I never wanted to have to ask her for anything. It would take me days to get up the nerve to ask her for anything, like whether it was, you know, something that she had to sign for school, or if there was something I needed or whatever. I was just terrified and like just nervous, and just it would take me forever to get up the nerve to ask her for anything. So So as soon as I could, I started making my own money so I wouldn't have to ask her for anything. I could, if there's something I wanted, I would buy it myself, you know. And I thought at that time that was kind of like the best we'd ever gotten along. Now, our paths hardly ever crossed. You know, I would get up and go to school in the morning. She'd get up and go to work. I'd go babysit after school, go home, make something to eat, do my homework, go to bed, and then she would come home. So we would never, our schedules didn't mesh, and my household was never one where, like, you know, you get up in the morning and you're super chattery with each other. You're like, oh, good morning. What are you doing today? Like that kind of atmosphere just was never in my house. But I didn't mind. I had developed the ability to be, you know, okay on my, you know, on my own, I guess, just through the years. We went on like that for, about 5 months. And like I said, I made friends, but I think she had met there was like two girls that I hung out with primarily. And, you know, we went to school together and I think she met them, but she didn't meet their parents. Like, you know, again, not Betty Crocker mom. So she's got no interest in meeting like my friend's parents, or, you know, there were no like barbecues with everyone or, you know, anything like that. She just did her own thing. And, but my friend's parents would always ask about her. And I would just always say, you know, she's just not there. You know, she was always like working or on a trip or something. And they just didn't understand that, you know, because they were the, you know, like typical parents. And they actually, later they would tell me that they actually thought at one point that I was a runaway and that I was living by myself. And they would drop by our house like at like random times, cause they, you know, just to see if they could meet her. And she was just never there. But it didn't, that didn't bother me. But then one time she went on a trip and I had dinner at my friend's house, like I did, you know, 100 times. And my friend's mom wouldn't let me leave. She was like, you're not going to go home and stay by yourself. Like, that's just not going to happen. You know, they just didn't understand how that could be. And so they had me, you know, had me stay at their house. Well, my mom ends up calling, yeah, you know, which it was rare. She just didn't do that, you know. And this is a long time ago, so there wasn't cell phones or stuff like that. I couldn't tell her or anything. So to her, I just wasn't home, and I was like running around in the streets. You know, again, she would always accuse me of things like that. I was, you know, of course, because I was a teenager, I was out like, you know, drinking and smoking and having sex and, you know, robbing banks or whatever. I don't know, whatever she got in her head that I was doing, was her reality. And so when she did come back, she was, you know, extremely angry. I got punished, of course. And then like, it wasn't that much longer after that she just one day said, you know, this isn't working out. And she would end up making me quit school. She would make me go to school and lie to them and say that there was like a family emergency and that we were moving back to the Southwest, but we were not going anywhere, just me. So I would, you know, did what she said. I mean, that's your mom, right? I mean, she sent my brother away. She can send me away, right? And I told my friends, and my friend's parents, you know, tried to talk to her. She wouldn't talk to anybody. And then she basically like put me on a plane and sent me back to the Southwest, which we had either sold our house or she was renting it out. There was nowhere. She was sending me back to nothing, right? There was no one there. There's no family, as I mentioned before. Don't have a big family, not close. So, you know, no, there's no one there. one of her friends that someone she used to date for quite a while when we lived there, the night before I left, he called. She must have told him something. And so he called and he was kind of questioning her and going like, what's wrong with you? You can't do that. Where's she going to go? What's she going to do? And he even said like, who's picking her up from the airport? Because where we used to live is not where you like fly into, let's say, right? It's because it's like equivalent to if you flew into like Los Angeles and then you had to drive an hour to get to where your actual destination. It's kind of like that. And she actually told him, she said, I don't know. She has friends. And something clicked in me that I was like, oh my God, like this is, here we go again. Like she had always exhibited, I didn't recognize it then as like jealousy, you know, when you start reading about narcissistic mothers and especially the narcissistic mother raising a daughter, there's a lot of different ways that, the narcissist can behave. And one of them is jealousy. And so, you know, all of that, a lot of that I mentioned before about how she would, you know, not accept compliments of me, not praise me, not accept praise about me, make me quit anything that I was good at or that I would receive, you know, praise for, like all of that is based in a certain amount of jealousy, right? And, but yeah, so she would put me on a plane and send me away, and I, because I didn't know that there was anything wrong with it, I just sort of, you know, lived my life. I knew I had to, my mind just immediately went to like, I need to get back in school because she had pulled me out of school prematurely. I need a job. I need a place to stay. And so I somehow, you know, lined all that up. But eventually I would be found out by the, by someone. It actually ended up being like an old friend of my mom who just happened to work in the juvenile court system, right? Because my mom at one point worked for the state, so a long time ago. So we met these people. I met social workers and attorneys and things like that. And I would run, you know, this is a small town, so I'd run into them. And when I would tell them that, I told them I was there by myself, they were just like, what? And that's when it was explained to me that what she had done was considered abandonment, neglect, you know, and on and on, that she could go to jail. And I had to be put in the system for a period of time and live at a foster home live with a foster family. That was horrible. And they just, I mean, it wasn't horrible. They were nice people, but they didn't understand me or where I was coming from. And they wanted to kind of make me part of their family. And I never had like a, you know, regular quote unquote, like, you know, family experience. So I didn't know what that was. And I had a lot of things on my mind at the time, you know, to me, I'm trying to figure out what I'm going to do with the rest of my life, you know, even though I'm only 16, I'm trying to figure out what's going on here. And they're, you know, they're wanting me to like go to church with them and, you know, babysit their kids and, you know, and all these things. And I was just like, oh my God, I told my social worker at the time, who was also an old family friend, luckily, that, you know, I was like, you got to get me out of here. I can't do this. You got to let me stay somewhere else, like with one of my friends or something. And so we were able to work that out. And then eventually I decided to go for, apply for emancipation because, the choice was I would either be sent back to my mom, which I knew she didn't want, but she wouldn't have had a choice because she was breaking the law. Or I could apply for emancipation, and which basically means like you're an adult. But you have to, it's a court filing, and then you have to have a hearing, and you go before a judge, and you basically have to exhibit that you can take care of yourself. And I had, you know, I'd already, like I said, I got myself back in school and finished my junior year. I had a job. I also had friends. The friends that I met on the West Coast offered to have me move back there if I wanted to and stay with them for my senior year of high school. And I also had people there in the Southwest that also wanted to, you know, wanted me to live with them. So I had options. And so I decided to do that. But before the judge would rubber stamp it, because the system is designed to put the family back together. So they had to give my mom an opportunity. You know, if she would have said that she wanted me back, then they would have sent me back to her. But we got on the phone and it was like on speaker, and they, you know, asked her a couple questions, and then she's talking to me and she asked me what I was going to do. And I, you know, and I told her that, you know, these friends wanted me to, you know, live with them. And she actually said that she didn't think it was a good idea because she didn't know them. And I don't know what got into me, but I actually said, well, at least they want me. And she responded, well, I guess that's true. And that was it. And so, you know, the judge was like, boom, rubber stamp, like, good luck to you, you know, like, yeah, you're good. But, you know, life is pretty good. I did not see or speak to my mom for 23 years after that initial split, right? Once I was emancipated, you know, she didn't make any attempt. And, you know, I kept in touch with my grandmother, and my grandmother would kind of like make these attempts to get us together over the years. And then, but my mom would always quash it, you know? So I just went on with my life. And I think I was lucky in a sense that I didn't have a strong connection to her, and it allowed me to break away. And then once I did break away, I was fine. You know, it scares me to think of what might have become of me if I had stayed with her, because I was so, my self-esteem was like so low with her. She was always, you know, she's doing all these things to me. She's gaslighting me. She's restricting me. And then she would turn around and say, what's the matter with you? What's wrong with you? Why are you, you know, I think you're depressed. Yeah. You need help, you know? And,
After this happens, mm-hmm. You're going through, you know, being adult. You're still, you know, you're young. You have a lot of responsibilities that most, almost all kids don't have.
Right.
And at what point do you start to look into, you know, these are the issues that I have that have stemmed from this relationship. How do I go about fixing them and doing the work on like figuring out what your mom is, was, mm-hmm. and like, did that happen immediately or did that start happening a bit later? And what was the process of it all?
Yeah. So that happened. Yeah. It was later. I can't remember how I first came across it. I think I was always an avid reader, and I started reading, and I was into like, you know, Stephen King and Dean Koontz and stuff like that. And then all of a sudden, like, but I also liked, you know, like mafia stories and things like that. And I started reading true crime books. Somehow I found a true crime book. I found Anne Rule. And I start reading these true crime books, and on a lot of them, you know, there's a like a malignant narcissist, right? Like It's very, very dangerous, the most dangerous kind, the ones that, you know, won't let anybody go and stalk and murder and, you know, just horrible, horrible people. But somewhere in there, it turned me to start reading about narcissists. Like, there were enough, like, even though those were extreme stories, there was enough in there that kind of got me thinking. And then I found some literature about the specific, like, the narcissistic mother and daughter relationship, and I was just like, oh my God. I mean, it was amazing. It was like I was reading about my life, you know. So that's what started me down that. And then you just, you know, you start reading more. And like I said, I was already out. So I'd done pretty well, you know? I kind of knew that. And I kind of knew that I got back in touch with my brother and I learned that he actually had a much harder time with her. Because he did have a connection and a relationship with her more than I did. And so even though he got away from, he has this, like, they have this, like, push-pull relationship still to this day, you know, they're in contact way more than we are. And she's still, like, you know, playing with him and it's awful. But he hates her, you know, he recognizes that she was not a good person and not a good mother. And he, you know, he tells her that he had a horrible childhood and that there's a lot of things in his adult life that he doesn't enjoy right, you know, now because of her. But, and I applaud him for saying those things to her. But then what she does is she calls me and tells me, can you believe your brother said this to me? And I'm like, are you really calling me to complain about my brother telling the truth about his experience with his childhood? I'm like, she just has zero self-awareness at all. So yeah, so I learned, you know, I learned a lot. I kept reading and the one area of my life, this kind of leads into the next experience that I have with a narcissist and you know, we're kind of using that term broadly, but the one area of my life that I maybe had a question about was like romantic relationships, or am I capable of having a close relationship? Like, I have friends, yeah, okay. I had some relationships in college and stuff like that, and they seem to have ended, you know, the way, you know, some relationships do, that you just fizzle out. But I knew, like, I didn't want I was not attracted to the traditional, like, roles that people have in relationships. So if I was in a relationship, especially when I was younger, like in my 20s, even 30s, if I was in a relationship with someone and they started talking about, like, marriage and stuff like that, I was like, ugh, what? No, no, no. I was just not focused on that at all. And I don't think I have a biological clock. That just, you know, having kids surprise, surprise, that never sounded like a good idea to me, you know.
Having dinner at 6:30 every day doesn't appeal to you.
Right. I, you know, it's so funny, even though I am a structured, disciplined, I don't like routine. I don't like things that are like super routine. So even my profession, even though, yes, I get up and I go to work every day, but my job, what I do every day is not the same. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I couldn't, you know, I couldn't work like in a factory or something, like, you know what I mean? Something like that. So even though I have structure in my life, I have discipline, I have, you know, I've never been in trouble with the law. I have good credit, I have money in the bank, that kind of thing. I've always had good jobs. I've always lived in, I've lived in the place I'm living now. I've been here for 10 years, but even before that, I lived in places like, at least like 4 years or 4 years here, 4 years there. So, but I don't like routine, and like, and marriage and kids to me just sounded like a loss of freedom. That's what it sounded like to me. So I'm like, oh my goodness, you have to, you have no choice. I take my hat off to people. I don't know how they do it. Because to me, I guess at a real, from a really young age, I recognized it for being as hard as it is. I didn't see it through rose colored glasses and think, oh, you get married and you have kids and it's, oh, it's so great. I was like, no, that looks really, really difficult. And there's just not enough hours in the day. Like, how is that even possible? I'm trying to just take care of myself and I need more time. So, yeah. So I take my hat off to people that can do it and do it well. But that was just never my focus. So anytime that came up in a relationship, I would feel like, okay, this person doesn't know who I am at all. If to even bring this up, like you're not paying attention kind of thing. Now, I didn't think as I got older, like in my 40s, I was kind of like, oh, this is kind of strange. I didn't actually think I'd be, still single at this age. I thought I would be like in a relationship of some sort, So I questioned myself. I didn't know if I was capable of that. And then my friends would always question and say, how come you're still single? People I would meet, I can't believe you're still single. Like, you're such a good catch, and they'd say, maybe you're too picky. Maybe you don't give people a chance. Maybe you need to be more flexible. And some of my friends would have relationships where they would, get in fights or break up, get back together kind of thing. That never made sense to me. But they were like, sometimes you have to go through conflict in order to make the relationship stronger. And so some of what people said kind of stuck in my head. And I would think like, well, maybe they're right. Maybe I'm not single because maybe it's not really my choice. Maybe it is because of how I conduct myself in relationships, and maybe I need to examine that, right?
So here we have these beliefs that are being implanted by your friends innocently, that I assume are going to become a big hindrance to you, because your belief now about what it takes to be in a relationship has been somewhat altered. And
right. And I'm seeing it too, right? Seeing it in my friends. I see their, I'm that person that people come to with their problems. Mm-hmm. And I would actually tell them, like, I don't know why you're coming to me. I haven't been in a serious relationship in really long time. I don't know if I'm the right person to talk to about this. Cause I was always pretty like hard lined. I was like, if something's wrong, if it's not working, then, get rid of it. And obviously not all things are like that. There's a lot of gray areas, but I didn't see those gray areas, but my friends were showing me gray areas. Right. And I was learning to like be more like, even with them, I had to learn to be like more, a little more empathetic, a little more, like instead of trying to give them advice, I would just listen and just, and I realized that even if someone is in a, not necessarily an abusive relationship, but just like a bad relationship, that they're not going to be done with it until they're done with it. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. You can tell them like, hey, I don't know if it's such a good idea for you. I don't think this person has your best interest at heart, but until they figure that out for themselves, they're gonna stay there. So I was learning these things.
So when do you meet the person that this your story is about?
So, yes. So, enter N number two. So I feel like I'm in a good place in my life. And I meet this person. And we meet in a social setting. And I just think he's, you know, he's physically, he's my type, you know, he's attractive, and he just seemed to be, you know, having a good time. We strike up a conversation, and pretty quickly, you know, exchange numbers, and like almost right away, we're spending a lot of time together. And, it's, you know, what I didn't recognize it for at the time was like, you know, the total love bombing. I mean, we were together all the time. I mean, unless I was working. And, from, you know, what I had experienced maybe in the past, it was a little shocking for me. This is not something I was used to, but then on the other hand, it was better than, you know, the people who say seem interested and then you never hear from them, right? So I thought, okay, well, this is, you know, he's obviously like really interested. So we go on like that. Like at one point we spent like a whole solid like 2 weeks together, like, you know, day, night. And I would just go to work, go to my house for a little bit. We lived close to each other, so it was easy to spend a lot of time together. And he would be calling me. He'd call me like several times during the day to find out what I was doing later. And then I would end up, you know, going to my house for a little bit and then going to his house. And then I'd go back to my house in the morning to get ready for work and, you know, rinse, repeat. And then when I would, okay. So during this time, during this like honeymoon period, if you will, he tells me his story, and I should have run, I guess, right there. But so he tells me his story, and he was in the military. He was suffering from PTSD. He also had like anxiety, panic attacks. He had some physical injuries, so he had pain. And he'd been married before. He had a couple kids. So his ex and his kids lived in another state. He had a strained relationship with his parents, and the rest of his family. You know, it was just like, oh my God. but at the same time, you know, I'm looking at my background and I'm kind of like, well, I can't hold that against somebody, right? Like they have a strained relationship with their parents or with their ex. I mean, that's kind of normal, you know, that can be normal. So he tells me all this and, you know, immediately I'm like, I feel sorry for him. I feel bad, you know, I feel badly for him. But I also felt like, I remember going home at one point and just being like really overwhelmed because he had a lot of stories and he was like telling me all these things and it was just like drinking from a fire hose. It was just like, you know, and so I remember feeling really overwhelmed and but feeling badly for him. And we kept spending time together, and I would witness like the anxiety and the panic attacks and stuff like that. He would also tell me that at one point when he got out of the service and then he was still with his wife, but then they got divorced. He said that he was homeless, like basically homeless for a while, and, you know, did a lot of drinking and drugs and stuff like that. But now he was, you know, now when I'm meeting him, he's receiving benefits, you know, from the government. He's in therapy. He goes to physical therapy and talk therapy. He's on a lot of medications for his, you know, anxiety, PTSD, like, you know, and then physical pain. And, but he's got his own place, you know, like he's getting better, right? He's working on it. So that's where I am with him. I'm thinking, okay, wow, this person's, you know, going through a lot. He's a vet. So, you know, he deserves, you know, what happened to him wasn't his fault, right? And he deserves, you know, to be getting, you know, all this help and hopefully, you know, he'll get better and like, you know, great. And so that's, you know, I thought that was it. And then the other bad behavior started. And
Before we get to the bad behavior, was there, I guess, as far as kind of hooking you in,
yeah.
Was there like future faking and
there
things
was a
like
lot
that?
Yeah, there was a lot of we, you know, there was a lot of, he had a lot of plans when there's, he wanted to take trips and we were just together all the time, you know. At one point he, you know, like we're together and like his phone rang and he's told me to answer it. Like, you know, little things like that. And I'm like, I don't want to answer your phone. And he's like, no, go ahead.
And being a real big trust type of vent where, oh, you can answer my
right.
phone. I don't care who's on the other end. You know,
right.
you're open to every part of my life.
Right. Exactly. And then later that the phone would play a big part in our like relationship. And he would use it almost like a weapon. It was like, it would get crazy. But yeah, so there was a little bit of that, but I think for me, kind of the bonding kind of happened just because of what he was telling me. You know, the other thing is when he told me all that stuff about himself, it was because he trusted me. So, you know, when the bad behavior started, I started kind of going like, what's happening here? Mm-hmm. When we would go out, so with the, not sure how to explain this. Like, he was very charismatic. He was like a social butterfly. He, you know, when we would go out, he would be like talking to everybody and things like that. And I didn't really, that didn't really bother me because I'm very social and I know a lot of people. So, you know, you go out, you run into people, you know, and I had been out with people before that would be very insecure about that and would not like that I, you know, that if we went somewhere and I ran into people that I knew, they seemed to be, you know, bothered by that. So I thought, oh, well, this is good. It's someone that's like as social as I am, like, and isn't going to be bothered by things like that. So I just thought, you know, I didn't see a problem with that. But then later, like a little later on, like, sometimes people, I noticed that sometimes people he was talking to, like you could just tell by someone's face and body language that they were kind of like, you know, oh my God, this guy is, you know, a lot. And people would say that to me a lot. They'd say, wow, he's a handful. And I would always say that, well, he's been through a lot. That was always my response. He's been through a lot, you know, because I'm thinking, any behavior that he exhibits is all about PTSD, mm-hmm. right? I'm attributing, you know, anything that comes up, whether if he's angry, if he's sad, if he's, you know, whatever his mood and whatever his behavior, I'm thinking it's related to PTSD. So then I start to realize the bad behavior starts coming up. I start to realize that he actually may have like an addiction problem. Like he drinks a lot. He definitely has an addictive behavior, right? So, um, So he's drinking a lot. He's on top of like all the medication that he takes, right? And so sometimes when we'd go out, like the nights would start with, you know, him all in a good mood and everything, and then by the end of the night he's like despondent and, you know, and crying or angry, and he's, you know, just, you know, threatening, you know, suicide, and just, you know, just, it's just like total, you know, craziness. Or then
so when that would happen, would you pass that off again? This is PTSD.
Oh,
you
yeah.
Know, this is just an episode. I'll be here to help. Are you thinking you can fix him?
No. Not fix him, but I think I need to be patient. Mm-hmm. I need to be, you know, I thought maybe this is the person that my friends told me about, that I need to give a chance, mm-hmm. that I need to, you know, I need to be more flexible. I need to be more understanding. I need to be patient. I need to go through conflict, right? Yeah, all of that. And he's telling me that I'm the type of person that he needs to be around, that I calm him down, that I'm, you know, since I'm such a good person, like, and he wants his life to be better, like, I'm the one who's going to, like, make this better.
Yeah, so in a way, there is a fixer element to it that's kind of running through you.
Yeah, I didn't think that, but he's telling me that. Mm-hmm. Right.
Yep.
I wasn't running around going like, I need to fix it, you know, like, or trying to do anything. He was doing what he was supposed to be doing. He was going to therapy and stuff like that.
But in a way, that statement that he puts out there,
right,
is sowing a seed of you staying around. It's like when someone is going to fake commit suicide, or they say, I'm going to commit suicide, for that person who's in a relationship with them, all of a sudden it freezes them and thinks that they're responsible, so they have to stay. Him saying that to you about you're the one that's a fixer is going to keep you in, because now you believe you're the only one that can help, or that you have guilt to help.
Right.
Is that fair?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah, definitely. So he had like no regard for I started noticing like he didn't seem to have regard for other people's like feelings or time or boundaries, right? He was always rushing me. Like I mentioned the phone again, right? The phone played like such a huge part, because he was always calling me, and even times where I would get away and say, I need to stay home today. I have things I need to do. I want to go to the gym, like stuff like that. He would end up calling me like in the middle of whatever it was I was doing. And he'd have, you know, say he was having like a panic attack and needed me to come over. And, you know, and of course I did. In the beginning, I was dropping everything to go to help him. Right. Or, you know, to be with him. I even took him to the hospital a couple times when he had the panic attacks. And one of the times, like, he had his dad, he had started talking to his parents again, and his dad came to the hospital. And, you know, and I can't remember what I was in the middle of doing. I might've been at the gym or something, but I just went, you know, the way I was, right? Like, so I'm just like, you know, no hair, no makeup, you know, just in my workout clothes or whatever, just, you know. And later on, and so on. So now I meet his dad, like under these like weird conditions. And then later on, he would say, you know, nice first impression. and you know, that would make me feel horrible, right? But I still didn't recognize it as like, I think I blamed myself. I was like, oh yeah, maybe I should have like, you know, looked better when I was rushing you to the hospital. So he was always rushing me to get to his house, like always calling, wondering where I was. stuff like that. And then when I would get there, like let's say we were going out or something, and then when I would get there, he wouldn't be ready. And then I would, you know, I'd be sitting there sometimes for hours, like waiting for him to get ready. He was very, very concerned with his appearance, and would sit there messing with his hair and, you know, change clothes three times. And then he would, like, he was easily distracted. He'd start, like, organizing his closet or, you know, or looking up something online or talking to somebody on the phone or whatever. And it was like, you know, and you're sitting there like, come on, I thought we were leaving. You made me rush over here. And now, you know, you're not ready. You know, it was like, annoying, right? And then he would call people, like, you know, in the middle of the night. He would go by their, like, if we were out driving around, he'd go by someone's house, and like at all hours. He just, like, really had no regard for anyone's, you know, time or feelings or whatever. He was the only one that could have emotions, you know, like if you, for instance, some of these nights where we go out and he would end up, you know, just acting manic. He's throwing money around. He wants to go to this place and then that place. And then if any time, like when he's ready to leave, it's time to leave. Like whether you're like in the middle of talking to somebody or eating something or whatever, it's like he would say he's having anxiety and it's, you know, and it was time to leave. And then sometimes at night, like I couldn't get him out of the car because now he wants to sit there and like listen to music and like, you know, talk, and then he'd start crying, and then, you know, and if I brought it up the next day, like, hey, can we talk about what happened last night? He would say that I was triggering him and that he didn't need the negativity and, you know, and that if I wanted to, there was a lot of like, if I was going to be with him, then I had to be this way, you know, or that way. There were a lot of rules. He had a lot of rules for people and a lot of types of people he couldn't be around or be associated with. And there was like, you know, he was constantly talking, telling his opinions of people and talking bad about people, even his own friends. You know, he would talk bad about them. This one couple in particular, and we got along really well, and we decided to get together independent of him, because there were times where we were all supposed to hang out and he wouldn't show up. He didn't show up. So we just decided, like, well, let's just, you know, we'll just hang out on our own. And we had fun. And so we exchanged numbers and we decided we were going to get together, you know, on our own. He didn't like that. He didn't want that. He didn't want me hanging out with them without him, because he didn't want us talking about him behind his back. So, you know, that's that trying to keep everybody separated so they can't compare notes, compare stories about him.
So he liked to compartmentalize his relationships so no one could talk to each other,
right?
As far as, hey, these things are really weird that are going on, you know, and there's no, you know, if no one can cross paths, the better. And he knew that from the beginning.
Right, right. Then he started being, so we had, you know, this has been maybe like a few months in, and these nights, these crazy nights that I keep talking about are happening like more and more. Plus I also find out that he's gambling a lot. And at first I thought it was just like recreational, you know, because I mean, I gamble, I go to Vegas, whatever, but he was going to like these local casinos and would, you know, spend many, many hours at these places and lose money. Sometimes he'd win money, but, you know, most of the time he'd lose money. He'd call me in the middle of the night to go pick him up from some of these places. That's how I found out about it, because he'd call me in the middle of the night and need a ride from somewhere. Because he didn't have money for it. This was before Uber and everything, and he didn't have money for a taxi. And of course, like, whenever he would call like that, he would call, sometimes he'd call, like, and this is during the week sometimes. So I got to get up and go. He didn't work. I got to get up and go to work. And he's calling me in the middle of the night to, like, you know, because he's either having a panic attack or he needs to be picked up from somewhere. And it's either like a casino or a bar or something, right? And then sometimes when I'd get there, and of course I'm worried about him, right? I'm worried what's going to happen to him if I don't, you know? And then when I'd get there, he wouldn't always, it's not like he'd be standing there ready to leave. I'd have to go find him a lot of the times. So here I am, I got out of bed, threw on like whatever, and now I have to go walk into some like casino or bar and go find him. And he'd be there, you know, either if it was a casino, he'd still be gambling. I'm like, I thought you were done. And, you know, I don't know if he got money from someone or if he lied about not having money or what the situation was. And then, you know, and like an idiot, I'd sit there and wait, right, until he was done. Then he'd want to, like, go get food somewhere. And then he'd, you know, I mean, it was
so it sounds like, you know, your relationship started. You're hooked in, you know, you fell for the whole victim part. You are kind of going off of the fumes of the things implanted in your head by your friends. He also has PTSD. That's a big part. And now you're in this stage where, you know, all of these behaviors are in the realm of control. And, you know, he is doing things his way. His anxiety pops up. You know, you have to do whatever he says. He's using that as a form of control.
Exactly.
You know, his anxiety, his PTSD, everything that goes along with that, to do whatever he wants. And,
right,
you know, in this process, are you fighting back at all early on, as not fighting back physically, but fighting back with words? Are you arguing any of your points? And does he start to devalue you in any way, if you do or you do not? And if he does certain things to you, are they aggressive? Are they passive aggressive type of things?
Yeah. So I do start, you know, well, like I said, I would, you know, try to talk about, like, you know, can we talk about what happened last night? You know, when he was like a night where he was particularly like, manic, and he would shut me down. You know, he didn't want to talk about it because talking about it, like, takes him through it again, and then that triggers him, and like, you know, he's quieting me, you know, pretty quickly, right? But then other times he would sort of recognize that he's a little out of control, and he would say, "Oh, I need to stop drinking. I need to, you know, do this," and then he maybe would for a while, but it wouldn't last. Every once in a while I would be like, you know, this is, you know, in the moment, like while it's happening, I would be like, this is ridiculous. I'm out of here. You know, I'm leaving. And then he would, you know, be like, you know, crying or upset or something like that. And then you're like, and then I would be like afraid of what he would do to himself. But then pretty quickly he started he was definitely passive aggressive. If he would call me and I didn't answer the phone, but I called back, like, you know, like you see the, you don't notice right away that the phone's ringing, and then you're like, oh, but then it's too late. So, but then you call the person right back, he wouldn't answer. And then, or he would call and then say, I have to call you right back because someone else was calling. And then he wouldn't, sometimes for days. Sometimes, like, he wouldn't call back, wouldn't text back, like, for days. Until he realized, like, oh, there was something I could, you know, some favor I could do for him or something I could do for him. And then he'd call and he'd want to get together, you know, he'd want to hang out or something. So that started happening. He had these friends, quote unquote friends, that he said he didn't want me to meet because they weren't the type of people that I should hang out with. But yet he would talk about them all the time, talk to them all the time, sometimes at length on the phone, even when I was with him, and he would never mention that I was with him or that he had plans with me. And then if they had something going on, he would drop everything and go be with them. He did that a lot. Like, there were times when we were supposed to do something or we were together, and then all of a sudden he would just change his plans and go do something else, like, without me. Yeah, that started happening. Then he started turning me against myself, I guess is a way to explain it. Mm-hmm. So he would, things that I considered my strengths, he started devaluing, I have a college degree, and he would say, oh, that doesn't really matter. You know, like, you can get rich or whatever, like, without that, you can make money without that. It doesn't really mean anything. He was always asking me, he would ask me, you know, why I never got married and had kids. And when I would say, like, it was my choice, he would say that it was because no one wanted to be with me and because I was selfish. And sometimes he would just say that out of nowhere, like, just, you know, like, be sitting there doing something else. And he would say, God, no one wanted to be with you. Just like that. How come no one wanted to be with you? He would, you know, it obviously was a question I wasn't supposed to answer, but he would do that a lot. He'd bring that up.
And then, did you start believing these things?
It made me feel bad. I don't know if I believed it, but I guess I did a little bit. I mean, it would make me think about it, right? Like, yeah, how come, maybe, yeah, no one, you know, well, I am, here I am at the age that I am, and I'm single, so yeah, I guess maybe there's some truth to that. And he would even say, like, did anyone ever ask you to marry them? Like, you know, he was really getting to the, you know, trying to make that point that if no one's ever asked you, then wow, like, no one wanted to be with you. Like, yeah, just really making that point.
And, you know, I guess throughout this meat and potatoes of your relationship and all these things going on, were you catching him in lies or projections where, you know, something might be going, he might accuse you of anything that might be going on in his life that he kind of is doing a swerve? Is there any financial abuse or anything like that?
Yeah, so the financial comes up, but I think I just started noticing, like, that he was just a walking contradiction, right? You know, he had a way that he had all these rules and all these ways that people needed to be around him, but he didn't care how he acted, you know, toward people. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So there's, yeah, so I'm noticing that, just mainly that, just like the contradict, the fact that he could sit there and spew at me, you know, about, you know, everything under the sun for like hours. But if I tried to, you know, like bring something up, like it's like shut down immediately, you know, you immediately get to that. I don't want to talk about that. Like, you know, that's triggering my anxiety, you know. Like you're starting to make me anxious or whatever. Like
he had two sets of rules, and he hit it the two sets of rules by saying that his PTSD was triggered when talking about these things, so he never ever had to address them, and that was his way of getting out of it.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So then, so I mentioned the gambling, and so. Early on, or, you know, when I first, you know, maybe the first couple times I like picked him up at a casino or whatever, I was still thinking like, okay, it's a little weird, but it's recreational. He doesn't work. So he can go, you know, he can do this kind of stuff whenever he wants. Right. But he asked me for, we were out somewhere and he wanted to go gamble, and he didn't have a lot of cash on him. And so he asked to borrow some money. And so I thought, oh, okay, you know, gave him like, I don't know, maybe like $50 or something. And he went and gambled and he won money and he paid me back. Now also throughout the relationship, I'm doing things for him. I started like doing things for him, like little running errands, picking up food. Like if I was on my way over to his house, he'd be like, hey, he'd call me and say, hey, can you stop at the store and like get this or get that or whatever. And at first, you know, I didn't mind, you know, I thought, yeah, sure. And then also, you know, I've always had friends where, you know, it was like the relationship was always very reciprocal. So, especially like working in the restaurant business, like we, you know, when I worked in the restaurant business and a lot of my friends were also, you know, servers and bartenders and stuff like that. It's like an unwritten rule. Like, you know, you go out one night, you go out with someone one night and maybe they pay. And then the next time you go out, you pay. And you know what I mean? Like you never had to talk about it. It just happened. Right. So I'm thinking, okay, well, I'll go and, you know, get these things for him. And then at some point, like, he'll either give me money for it or he'll take me out or something, you know. But, of course, that would never happen. or he'd say, oh, I'll give you money when you know, I get my check or whatever, because he had a couple checks that he got from the government, like, at certain times in the month. So he's like, oh, I'll give you money when, you know, XYZ. But then that wouldn't happen. And I started kind of like not keeping account, that would come later, but just kind of keeping track of that. And I was like, oh, okay. I was like, did he just forget or like, you know, what's going on here? So he asked us to borrow some money. So I lend him some money. So he wins and he pays me back. But he could have given me more money, right? Like to cover, you know, the other stuff that I had done for him, right? So I'm never even, you know, he's paying, you know, I gave him money, he paid me back. But in truth, he could have paid me back a little more. So that happened a couple of times. And I didn't realize at the time that it was kind of setting me up for requests to borrow like larger amounts of money later and longer time to pay it back, right? So he's borrowing small amounts and paying me back right away so that I won't be worried about it, about him borrowing, you know, more money later on.
That's a real pool hustler move.
Right. Right.
Where, you know, you start winning these little games, and they're like, oh, let's play the big one. And then, you know, they clean your clock.
Right. So that's how that started. Then it moved into, there was something wrong with one of his, you know, benefits, you know, his checks or whatever that he was getting, or it wasn't coming on time, or like the timing between the two was such that you know, sometimes he'd have a hard time, you know, making ends meet. So then he started asking to borrow, you know, to borrow maybe like $100 or a couple $100 or something like that. And again, you know, I'm at this point in my life, I have extra money. I'm like, you know, I'm feeling pretty solid, you know, and all of this. And so I'm like thinking, okay, yeah, maybe he just needs a little help. Maybe he just needs a little help. Maybe he just needs a little understanding. And so I started lending him money, and sometimes he'd pay me a little bit. Sometimes he would actually pay me money and then the next day ask for some or all of it back. Right? He would write checks to me and then, you know, to pay me back and then ask me not to cash them. I still have those checks, by the way. I keep them as a reminder.
So part of it, you're getting the feeling that you might be paid or might not be paid, but at least there's this weird effort that might be made. It's not a real effort, but you're getting a sense of somewhat security to keep it going.
There's a little effort, but I'm also noticing that you know, during this time, by the way, his anxiety and all of that seems to be diminishing. Like there aren't as many panic attacks. He got off a lot of the medication, you know, and stuff like that. So he seems to be doing better, right? We're not seeing a whole lot of each other. Now that he owes me money, he's ghosting me a little bit, right? We're not seeing, at this point, we're no longer like a couple. Now we're just friends, right? He, you know, made that determination at one point that, you know, that he didn't think we should be together, but that he really valued my friendship. So now we're friends.
So I guess for one second, how did that move happen? Did it slowly happen that way, or like was it by design? Do you think?
Was it
a way of like distancing you to eventually get out of it?
Well, he started with the phone games, right? And then disappearing on the weekends to go hang out with these other friends and stuff like that. And it just sort of, I mean, it didn't feel like a relationship. So, you know, I kind of maybe I asked, you know, what was going on. And he, you know, and he just was like, we're not together. You know, we're not together. Almost like it was never that way. You know, we're not together.
And how did you feel about that? What happened? Like, were you upset? Where did you go?
Yeah.
So what were the depths of your feelings on that?
Yeah, I was upset, but I also, because I had felt so overwhelmed with him and everything about him, that I was kind of happy to like resume my life, you know? I started, because at the time when I was with him, you know, sort of when things were in this like this whirlwind of like being with him all the time and him calling all the time and like dropping everything to either help him with something or be with him or whatever, I wasn't doing any of the things that I normally did in my life. I wasn't sleeping well. I wasn't working out. He used to eat like crappy food, fast food. I would eat with him. So I'm eating bad food. I'm not hanging out with my friends. I'm not doing any of the things, you know, in my life that I used to do and that I enjoy. So even though, yeah, I was upset about it, I kind of was, you know, was also like, I need to get, you know, I had that feeling like I need to get my life back. You know, I need to get back to the things that I like to do. So that's how I was feeling. And then, so now in this like friendship, quote unquote, now he's calling, you know, every once in a while, like every, maybe once a week or, you know, every other week. And usually it's to, borrow more money. And now I'm starting to, that was kind of a turning point for me. The money was a turning point because it had taken me a long time, to be at a place where I felt financially secure, you know, in my life. And that was like that's a very important thing for me. And I'm not like rich by any means or anything like that, but that's a very big thing for me because I don't have anybody to fall back on. Right. So I always had to make sure that I was, you know, okay financially. And I wasn't for a long time. Like, right, you know, when I got out of college, I had, you know, I had student loans and I'm paying for my own place and my own car. And I'm, you know, working like three jobs. And, you know, I mean, I didn't have enough to where I was like saving money or putting away for retirement or anything like that. I mean, that took a while for me to get to that point. And, but that's where but I was there and I'd been there for a while and, you know, I knew what it was like to have nothing and I was never going to go back there, you know, I was never going to go back there again. But he's borrowing money from me and he's always saying that he's going to pay it back because he had like some windfall. There was like some windfall of money that he was supposed to be coming into. That was like, it was always right around the corner. It was like a week away, 2 weeks away, a month away. You know, there was always this money that he was supposed to be getting. And then he said he would pay me everything he owed me like all at once. Right. So I still don't know why I kept lending him money, but I did. But now I'm starting to look at this differently. And I had researched a lot about PTSD and, you know, for that time when I was still attributing all of his behavior to PTSD, I was like, okay, I need to learn about this so I know how to deal with him. And then once, you know, I started noticing like his anxiety and his panic attacks and stuff like that, he actually did start like, you know, being healthier, like, you know, eating healthier and working out and stuff like that. And I'm noticing like he seems to be doing a lot better, but he's still an a-hole, right? He's still not a good, not a nice person, you know? He's still ghosting me, triangulating me, like all these things. I sat down one day and, you know, I was always like anxious, like wondering like, is he going to call? When's he going to call? What's he doing? Is he going to pay me back? You know, it was just on my mind like constantly. Plus, I'm also running through like the things that had happened in the past few months, right? Like all of those manic, you know, those nights where he was like, you know, with the manic behavior and the gambling and the, you know, I'm just like all that stuff is running through my head, and so I sat down and I just examined like how I was feeling one day, and it just hit me. That I felt that same way when I was like growing up, that anxiety, that uncertainty, like loss of, you know, self-esteem, you know, the low self-esteem, the, you know, all of that just kind of came back to me. And it was like, I don't know, it was like a lightning bolt hit me. And then I went online like a lot of people in these situations do. And I just started you know, putting in like, what does it mean when someone does this to you or acts this way or whatever? And these things start popping up, like, are you dating a narcissist? are you dating a psychopath? Like, you know, and I was just like, oh my God, why did I not see this? Like, he hits every criteria. I mean, just unbelievable. And then I knew, like, that I was in trouble, and that I had to get out of it. And I started, you know, everything, you read a lot. I started reading everything I could. I read articles. I read books. I went on some forums. I know you don't like those, but I did. And I swear it was so, in some instances, I would read somebody's story and I thought we were talking about the same person. And I'm not saying that like in a joking way. I mean, I really thought, I was like, where is this person from? Like, you know, are we talking about the same person? Because the tools that are used, the tools in the narcissist's toolbox that are being used are so common, right? And so I knew I knew I had to go no contact, and I knew, but he owes me money. And it had grown to a pretty significant amount. I mean, he almost like wiped out my savings. The last money that I gave him was to cover a bad check that he wrote for a new car. So, and the way I found out about that is that, you know, I hadn't heard from him in a little while. And then all of a sudden he contacted me and he wanted to like go to the beach or something, you know, one day. And so I said, okay, you know, we're supposed to be friends, right? So this is, you know, I'm trying to be friendly.
Do you see these acts of wanting to go to the beach and things like that as breadcrumbs, as I'm like, let's do something normal here? So to normalize things so then I can take advantage of you again?
I see them as, I'm hoping that they're steps in the right direction. I'm hoping that, you know, that they're like, okay, you know, we're going to do something normal, and then maybe he's going to pay me a little bit of what he owes me, and, you know, we're just going to have like this sort of normal friendship. That's what I'm hoping. But I'm also...
Is one of your fears that, okay, if I cut things off right now, I'm never going to see that money again?
Absolutely.
Okay.
I knew, yeah, absolutely. Like, I felt like I had to sort of, like, play nice in order to even have a chance at like, because now that I'm seeing things for what they are, like, my sympathy for him is gone. My sympathy's gone. But I'm also now, I know, like, oh, shoot, I'm in this, like, weird situation with him now. He doesn't know that I'm seeing these things as him, you know, treating me badly, and that, so I need to like, and I want to get my money back. So I felt like I had to like sort of play along in order to have a chance at that if I like called him out on his behavior and then just, you know, got away from him, that would almost be giving him permission to then just disappear, mm-hmm. right? And not, you know, not pay me back anything. So I felt like I had to stay there. You know, so he would contact me. So now on, but before, like, I would be maybe trying to contact him and trying to make plans with him, you know, and then he would just sometimes he would, and then other times he would just, you know, not take my calls or whatever. So now I'm not calling him at all. I'm not contacting him. He's contacting me. And so he wants to go to the beach or whatever, and he shows up in a brand new car. And I was like, wait a minute. You're like, you owe me money and you're out buying a new car? Like, what's going on? And And so that day he's telling me again about this, you know, the story about some the money that he's supposed to be getting and all of that. But that's why he got the car, is because this money that he always talked about, like for months now, that he talked about getting, like that was supposed to be happening. And I still to this day don't even know if that was true. But at some point during the day, he says that that they're going to, that the money didn't come in when it was supposed to. And so the check that he wrote for the car didn't clear. And now they were going to, you know, repossess the car. And could I help him? And I said, no, you know, I was like, no, I was like, take it back. I was like, tell them that you're mentally ill and that you shouldn't be entering into contracts. That's what I said. So tell me you have PTSD and all this, and that you shouldn't be entering into, you shouldn't be entering into contracts, and take the car back. And I, you know, I said, I wouldn't give him money. And I said that, you know, being in the legal field, I said, like, you know, I'll do some research and see what your options are. But I didn't know how long he had the car. And it turned out that he had already had it for like over a month. And that even if he did take it back, he would still be on the hook for the loan. So then he wanted me to buy the car. Like, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like change it all over into my name, but then let him drive it. I was like, what? That makes no sense. I was like, why am I going to buy a car that I had no access, that then I don't have access to? And I was like, so I have to buy the car, insure it, and then let you drive it around? No. I'm like, no, sorry. That's not going to happen. It was just, and I'm sitting there. So now I'm sitting there like in a different headspace. Right. And I'm just like, oh my God, the gall, right, of this person, you know, like, oh my, this is unbelievable to me. And, finally I said, you know, I said, okay, look, I'll help you out, because it doesn't make sense for you to be without a car and still responsible for the loan. You know,
just so you know, when you said, I will help you out, I guarantee you there's a collective groan from everyone listening being like, no.
I know. God, I know. Trust me, I was there. I was there, and I was just, oh, I couldn't believe it. And so I said, okay, I'm going to help you out, because it doesn't make sense for you to be responsible for this loan and not have a car. And then I'm not going to buy the car. I had the car that I had at the time was like 13 years old. It had been paid off for a long time, but I knew I was going to have to buy myself a new car like in the next year. I'd already started looking, right? So I'm not going to buy him a car, you know, and then not be able to buy myself a car, right? I was like, this guy's, you're messing with my financial future. And it's really, this is starting to, you know, really, you know, bother me, because now this is like, you're really messing with my life now.
So is your decision making here, is it guilt? Or is it, this is the only way I can think of how to get my money back is by giving more money?
It was a little bit, you know, so in that situation, I mean, maybe he could have gotten the money from someone else. Mm-hmm. But I don't know why. Yeah, I guess a little bit was, you know, well, he's got to, you know, if I do this thing for him, he's got to pay me back, right? Like, this is such a big deal, right? This isn't like, you know, a couple hundred dollars here and a couple hundred dollars there for like random things, you know.
But deep down, you know, if you don't do it, it's gone.
If I don't do it, yeah, there's definitely. Oh yeah, he would probably just like dismiss me and just disappear.
Because in a way, right now, if you kind of take a step back and look, you've already been discarded in a way.
Right.
You know, your relationship just ended when he wanted it over and discarded. So right now you are, he doesn't have to deal with any of you on a daily basis, a sense of like you saying, hey, why are you doing this? Why are you doing that? And mm-hmm. you've now been put into this friend zone where he can contact right. you when he wants, and he still uses you as supply, especially for money. Who knows what else he's getting from everyone else? But now you've been brought in and now are compartmentalized and are separated.
Right. And and it's pretty much all about money now. Yeah. And like the little crumbs, like you say, you know, of like, oh, let's go do this or, oh, let's do that. That's just to keep me sort of like in that, you know, loop. Just
yes.
to keep me sort of tied. He doesn't want me getting too far away because remember, I started like resuming my life, right? But he doesn't want me to get too far away. So he's like, you know, there were late night calls, you know, like it was like his PTSD and anxiety and panic attacks and stuff like that would flare up like when he wanted them to, you know, and it's, you know, and it'd be that, you know, he's calling, sounding desperate and, you know, and, you know, it's like when it, you know, needs somebody to talk to or whatever. But that's all just designed just to keep me sort of in that loop. So I said, I'd give him the money for the car. But I said, but not until you have to start paying me back what you owe me. And we need to figure out a way where, because at this point, you know, like I said, he'd already, you know, he had like written me checks and then told me not to cash them and given me money and asked for it back and all that kind of stuff. So I, you know, I didn't want to have to chase him for it. I said, we have to figure out a way where you can pay me and I don't have to have contact with you. I don't have to ask you for it or chase you for it. I'm not going to do that. So we figured out a way to where one of his checks that he got would go directly to me. And I opened up like a whole separate bank account because obviously I don't want him mixing in my bank account. So I opened up a whole separate bank account and he had that check routed to that account. Like on a monthly basis. And so we set that up and then I gave him the money for the truck. Now, what's weird is like he doesn't have the PIN number for that account. So he can't get any money out of it. It's just to put the money in. But he has control over that. He could stop that at any time. So every month I was like, I knew when the check was supposed to be in there. And every month I was like, panicked, you know, I was like checking to see if it went in because he could just decide to stop doing that. Right. So it's like this little victory, right, that he's actually paying me, but yet he still has control because he could stop it at any time. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, but now he's not really talking to me at all, which was actually fantastic. Like, at this point, I was like, good. The money's coming in. I don't have, you know, I'm not in contact with him. You know, I'm not, you know, I stopped answering his calls. And I was like, okay, this is good. Things are good now. Then he starts up again with the late night phone calls and now he's texting. You know, and surprising or maybe not surprisingly, more requests for more money. And I'm like, you've got to be, and I'm texting him back saying, you've got to be out of your mind. Like, no. And he would berate me over text, you know, saying, you know, like, why won't you help me? I know you can help me. I'm like, I don't have the money. I would just tell him straight out, like, I don't have it anymore. I gave you, you know, I already gave you like so much money. Like, you're messing with, you know, you messed with my financial security and I won't do it. You know, we're done. And I almost like, it was almost like morbid curiosity that once I said it like that plainly that, you know, I said, you're messing with my financial security. I, you know, I'm not giving you another dime. I've been, you know, in my life where I had nothing and I'm never going there again for anybody. And I had this little sense of morbid curiosity where I wanted to see how far he would go once I told him that. And he kept going. He every once in a while, he would just still show up and still text and still call and still ask for more money and still, you know, do the, like, you know, like he's, and the stories he would come up with, you know, for the reason that he needed it and his, and the whole plan that he had for, you know, like after he pays, you know, like we could just add it to what he already owes me. And then he'll pay me back like with interest. And he would bring up like spreadsheets that would show like, you know, how much more I would get back. Like if, you know, with the interest he was going to pay me, and then we could maybe go on a trip together and stuff. I was just like, but at this point, by now, by that point, this is about almost a year in. And by this point, I'm just like, I'm impervious to like his stories and his thing. I have no sympathy for him at all. I'm still just like keeping in contact once in a while just to make sure the money keeps coming in. But, you know, and I'm sort of humoring him by listening to all of these things. Like I had a choice. I mean, he would come over to my house and just like start spewing all this stuff. And then I would leave. I'd let him go through his whole spiel, almost like a salesman. And then at the end I would say, I'm sorry. No, can't do it. And I would leave. And I knew every single time that happened, it happened like a number of times. Every single time that happened, I knew like that there was a chance that he would try to like kind of like take revenge on me and like, you know, stop the checks from going into that account or something like that. I just, you know, I knew that chance was there, and I told myself that I had to be prepared for that. That I had to be prepared to walk away no matter what, and if that happened, I would just have to chalk it up to it being like an expensive lesson, and that, you know, but I had to be prepared for that to happen. And that's how I, you know, that's kind of how I got through it. Just like, you know, that's a reality. That's a possibility. I have to be prepared for that. And if it happens, so what? And, you know, just sort of like, I'm never giving him another dime. Like, this is done. I started turning my phone off at night because he would call, you know, and like in the morning there'd be like, you know, 8 or 10 like missed calls or text messages. So I started just turning my phone off at night when I'd go to bed. And I wouldn't turn it on again until I got to work, because then I wouldn't be tempted to like call him back or anything. And I just, you know, I just kept doing that. And so I could get myself like further and further away. And surprisingly, he did keep paying me. And then he started going to school. And then he's texting me and contacting me and asking me for money for things he needs for school. You know, because he thinks that will be, you know, different. Like I'll look at that as like, oh, this is a good thing that he's doing. And yes, this should be supported, you know, kind of thing, because that's how I was before. Right. But I was like, no, not happening. And he would get pretty irate, with me and accuse me of lying about, you know, how much money I had and how much money I made and, you know, and he's like, I know you make a lot, you know, I know you make enough money and this and that. And then other times he would try to devalue my work and say that he probably made more money than me for doing nothing. So it goes on like this, and I'm turning my phone off at night and trying to do no contact and this and that. And then the most amazing thing happens. He meets someone else. And that would be like on one hand, it was great because now he's not focused on me at all. But I admit I did fall down. I fell down that rabbit hole of like being curious about the new supply and wondering if she was experiencing the same things that I did. And I did some cyber stalking and they were, you know, and was, you know, kind of surprised to see that, you know, how love deaf they seemed and everything. And I was also surprised that like there was all this social media out there because another thing he was always like really paranoid about. And I didn't really use it a lot back then. I didn't, you know, I've never been like a big picture taker and all of that. So that didn't, you know, never came up in our relationship. You know, I just knew it was something he didn't, you know, he was kind of paranoid about, like didn't want people like, you know, talking about him, posting about him, stuff like that. But then here he is with this person, like, you know, splashed all over and all of these like, you know, going places and doing things and all these like, you know, all this affection being thrown around and it looked nothing. I thought it looked nothing like most of the relationship that I had with him.
Did you wonder to yourself, this is the relationship and the guy that I wanted. He's having it with this person. Is there something wrong with me? Did that ever pop in your mind? Okay.
Yeah. I thought because that's what I was looking for, right? I was looking for similarities, but I wasn't seeing them. So then I thought, well, wait a minute. What was it about me that allowed him to be so horrible to me? You know, like now he seems like almost PTSD free and he's, you know, he's got a new car. He's going to school and he's, you know, he's out and he's doing, you know, doing things and going places that were, you know, that we could never, some things that we could never do because of his, you know, because he said he was not able to or whatever. So I went through that whole, like, you know, what's wrong with me? You know, I went back into that and it took a while to, you know, to not feel, you know, really crappy about that. And to feel like, can't even explain it. You know, you just feel less than, I guess, like this, you know, this person must be. I was like, either she's putting up with a lot or he's changed. That was my thought. Like either it's happening and she's just putting up with it or maybe he's changed, kind of thing. And
not knowing is killing you internally the whole time. And
yeah,
in a way, you just want to know the reality of what's going on.
Yeah, and I'm trying not to cyberstalk, but you become almost obsessed, you know, like
yes.
You're, you know, especially once you find you get that out. And this is like, and I will say this is her social media, not his. Right. So this is her. This is all her, you know, doing this, putting these, you know, putting pictures up and all of this stuff. So it's kind of like her point of view, but it was all very, it was like almost like, you know, so sugary sweet. Like I was like, oh my God. And they actually, they were together for a while. You know, our mutual friends, like that couple that I became friends with, like, so he's hanging out with them now with this new person. And then I'm hanging out with them separately. So I'm hearing, you know, a little bit about the relationship, like through them, you know, but it all sounds, you know, perfectly, you know, fine, but they know him the way I know him. So they're kind of like, you know, that poor girl, you know, kind of thing. And I'm not saying that I know, I'm not telling them that I know anything about it or that I've seen anything. I'm just like, well, you know, you know, if they're happy, they're happy, you know, kind of thing.
And just a word for everyone who's listening, if you ever get into these situations where you have mutual friends that are still friends with both sides, ask those other people never to mention that other person to you in your presence. It's triggering. It keeps you involved in that world when you're trying to separate yourself. I'm sorry, I just had to put that in there,
right,
and get back to it. Sorry.
Right. Right. It does. You're right. Because, you know, there's these little crumbs there that, you know, where they're giving you this little view into this person's world that you no longer have contact with. Right. And you are curious, you know, but yeah, it's not a good place to be. But I'm sure at one point he told them like not to hang out with me or something. I don't know. We didn't become like good friends, but you know, we saw each other once in a while. So, I recognized the behavior that I was doing as like not good and then that I needed to just not be concerned with it. But it was really hard. It was really hard. Like just, you know, weaning myself off of that and not being curious and not wanting to look and see what was, you know, try to see what, you know, what was going on and things like that. So, let's see, I'm trying to heal myself. He's still paying me because, you know, he's distracted now. He's not contacting me. So, you know, my life is getting back to normal. Things are going pretty well, but we still live near each other. So there's still always that chance that you're going to run into, that I'm going to run into him or them, him and his new person, right? So every time I go out, you know, because like the little area that I live in is kind of like a cute little town, and it has its own, there's a street that has its own like restaurants and shops and stuff like that, and I can just walk there, so it's real convenient. But every time I always know people when I go out and stuff, run into people I know, but every time I go out, I have this like anxiety, like, that I'm going to run into him, you know, and at that point I had no idea like what he thought about me or how he would, if I did see him, how, if he would even speak to me, like I had no idea what was going on in his head, but I just knew how I felt every time I went out and there was a chance that I would run into him, even driving by his house, which was like my regular route home, unless I went a different way, I would feel myself getting anxious. You know, my heart would start beating and I, you know, just that anxiety would come up. And then one day I did, it happened. And I had started writing too, during that time of like trying to heal, trying to get your life back, you know, actually realizing what happened to you and what you were like sucked into and, you know, trying to figure out why and making sure it's not going to happen again. I went back to what I know and I started writing, and I would write, you know, sometimes I would write, accounts of like things that happened in the past. And, because it's almost like a dream, like you can't even believe it. And then other times I would write like what I would say to him if, you know, if given the opportunity, you know, almost like your letters to my narcissist. So I was doing a lot of that. I was doing a lot of writing, and it was really helpful just to get it out, to have it on paper and look at it and read it and just be like, oh my God, you know, like this really happened to me. This, you know, I really went through this. And then I did run into him, and it was in like a social place, social setting. And to my surprise, he was by himself. He wasn't with his new person. And to my surprise, he was like all happy to see me, you know, like, oh my God, how are you? You know, and wanted to sit down and catch up, you know, like we were like old friends that just hadn't seen each other in a long time. And so I agreed to sit down, and he's telling me like, you know, he wanted an update on where he was with paying me back. And I told them, you know, because I kept, I then I did have like a spreadsheet I was keeping, and I was keeping track of everything. And I told them, like, you know, he was about halfway done paying me back, and that I would for sure let him know, like, when, you know, when it was done. And he's talking about school and things like that, you know. And then he started talking about this new person that he's with. And one of the first things was, like, he made it sound like it was a new relationship, like they hadn't been seeing each other that long. When I knew they had been together already, like, for a year, if not a little more. But he made it sound like, you know, like they just started seeing each other. And he complained about her family. He complained about her friends. He didn't like any of them. He didn't think that they were good people. I think she had tattoos, and he didn't like that. And he said that he had asked her not to get any more tattoos, and she did anyway, and that he wasn't happy about that, but he thought it was trashy and, like, not ladylike. And he didn't say one good thing about her. He said that she was already complaining about, like, doing things for him, like doing his laundry. And what else did he say? Oh my God. It was just, you know, I was just sitting there stunned, like looking at him like he was like a animal in a zoo. And I was just like, wow, this is actually happening, like, right in front of my eyes. Like, he's devaluing her, you know, like, this is, it's like textbook. He even said that he said, I know it seems like I don't, but I think about you a lot. And he said that he talked to his new person about me and a lot, and how, and like what a good person I was, and how, like, she should be more, you know, like me. And I was like, well, okay, he's using me to triangulate her. Like, all this stuff that I've read now is, like, it's all just clicking and going through my head. And I'm like, this is incredible. And I remember what I said, but I know I stood up for her. I was like, hey, look, if you don't like, you know, it's her body, you know, about the tattoos, it's her body. If she wants tattoos, she can have tattoos. Like, if you don't like it, then don't be with her. Like, you know, and I'm like, okay, you know, he has not changed at all. You know, like, I don't care what is being shown on her social media platform, like, this is not a good situation, you know. There's no way she's happy in this. Like, this is, he has not changed at all.
So now that this is over, this person is no longer in your life, looking back at the situation growing up with your mom, being emancipated, all the issues that formed and the beliefs that kind of carried you through here, and also beliefs that formed during this relationship, you know, were there specific things you wanted to tackle that you've identified? Or is this just, you know, relearning what you already taught yourself and sticking to your guns?
Yeah, it's more like going back to, you know, like the way I was living my life before was fine. You know, it was just more of like, it just sort of reinforced that, again, like there's nothing. I had had someone, my mom at some point had sent me to a counselor when I was like 14. And because, you know, when she was telling me that I was depressed. And my mom, by the way, like she worked in the medical field. And for part of the time she worked in like psychiatric, she did some like psychiatric work. I remember specifically her saying that she was working at some point, she was working with people who were manic depressive. So this is something that I learned about, like, you know, as young. And so when she's sitting there telling me that she thinks I'm depressed, this isn't just coming from my mom. This is coming from like a medical professional, right? So I'm thinking, like, so she's telling me there's something wrong with me. I think, okay, maybe she's right. Maybe there is something wrong with me. And so I went to a counselor, and this counselor figured out pretty quickly what was going on. And she tried to set up sessions with both my mom and I. And my mom would either cancel at the last minute. And the last time she tried to set up a session, she tried like three or four times. The last time she tried to set up a session, my mom just didn't show up. And this lady, and now thinking about it, it's kind of funny because she was young, she was probably right out of grad school or something. And she was pissed, and not, you know, and cause she's thinking like, my mom's like a colleague, right? How dare you? How dare you, you know, like treat another medical professional this way? And also you're supposed to be a parent that's supposed to be concerned about your daughter. So she actually gave me a ride home. That was the last session I had with her. She gave me a ride home and she had me wait in the car and she went and talked to my mom, and my mom didn't let her in the house. They were just on the porch, but I could tell she was yelling at her and probably saying the same things that she said to me, like, how dare her, you know? Mm-hmm. And she got back in the car and she turned to me and she said, there's nothing wrong with you. Your mom is the problem. There is nothing wrong with you. And that definitely got me through the next few years, right? But it also, but now again, here I was decades later, having gone through this with, you know, this relationship and toxic friendship with this person. And again, I had to like, you know, that she was like the first person to tell me that. Other people would tell me that, like, you know, throughout the years, but here I was decades later, and I had to like repeat that, almost like repeat that to myself. Like, there's nothing wrong with me. Like, I was fine. I tried to fix myself by being with this person and bending over backwards and twisting myself into a pretzel to prove that I could have, like, you know, a relationship, you know, that I thought, you know,
That fits social norms.
That fits social norms. And that, you know, I had to prove that I was capable of caring about someone to a certain level or something. And then I realized that, you know, I picked the wrong person, obviously, or they picked me. It was just, you know, just the timing or whatever, but there was nothing wrong, you know, like I went through that and I had to learn from it, but yeah, there's nothing wrong with me. I don't need that. And I don't, I mean, if it happens, it happens. You know, I'm still open to having like a good relationship and, you know, a respectful, reciprocal relationship with someone. But yeah, I had to go back to like, you know, the way I, you know, what I was doing and the way I was living was completely fine. I didn't need that.
So before we end our show, do you have any words of wisdom or advice for everyone who is listening?
I don't know if it's really advice, but I will say that that you can experience or come across, like, you know, narcissists in different areas of your life. I think that's, you know, that's one thing that I learned. So you can have a parent who's a narcissist. You can have a boss who's a narcissist. And then, of course, the personal relationships, friends and significant others. I had a couple bosses, you know, but I recognized it right away. And I was like, ugh. You know? And it's good to recognize it and know that, like, okay, this is someone that I need to keep at arm's length, but it's not always that easy, right? Especially if it's a parent or a boss or something, you know, people you have to have contact with. So what becomes important, though, is, like, at least what became important to me was how I was feeling. You know, I had to really examine how I was feeling, how this person is making you feel. And is your life being disrupted? Your life as you knew it, is it, you know, hopefully your life, you liked the way it was before this person came into it. And now your life is being disrupted. And you have to really like stay in tune with how you're feeling and what's going on with you, and then determine like if this is a situation that needs to be addressed and that you need to like, you know, extricate yourself from somehow. But that's the thing that I noticed, was that even though these were two different people and two completely different types of relationships, the way that I felt in them was the same. And then the second one, that's what turned me around, was that I realized how I was feeling.
Well, Cece, I want to thank you for being here and sharing your story with us today. We pointed out a lot of things. You know, you did a really good job. So I just want to thank you from the bottom of my heart for being here today.
Thank you.
Because
it's so hard. Your brain is like all over the place, and I feel like it's so choppy.
Oh, no, I have my your notes in front of me. So I'm sitting here, and I'm like, yeah, you got it. Uh-huh. I know you wrote such thorough notes. It's hard to keep, and you're doing it from your side. It's very hard to keep track.
I'm not looking at them. I thought of trying to have them on the side, but then I thought I'd be like distracted and trying to, you know what I mean?
Oh yeah.
To rehearse or something. So I decided just to do it, you know.
Well, you did great.
Hear it from my brain.
You did great. And thank you so much for sharing.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And for everyone who is listening, from Cece and I, we hope you have a good night.
Oh, one more thing.
One more thing? Okay, hold on. That was a false ending.
I'm sorry. Because this is really important. There's one more thing to everybody out there. You're not crazy. You're not crazy. And there's nothing wrong with you. Okay, I'm sorry.
And on that note, everyone who is listening, you're not crazy. And from Cece and I, we hope you have a good night.